Today's program has been brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com. Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
When they want you to buy something, they will call you. When they want you to die for profit, they will let you know. So, friends, every day, do something that won't compute. Once again, you've tuned into the Heritage Radio Network, and you're listening to The Farm Report. I'm your host, Erin Fairbanks, and we are coming to you live from the back of Roberta's in beautiful Bushwick, Brooklyn. And today, once again, we are on the line with Janice Ray, author of The Seed Underground, A Growing Revolution to Save Food. And that quote I read was from Wendell Berry, his manifesto, The Mad Farmer Liberation Front. And Janice, you opened your book with that quote, and I'm just wondering if you could tell us a little bit about why you felt that was the most appropriate way to introduce your work.
I think it says it all, in a way. When we boil down what's happening with our food supply and agriculture, it really is that the industrialization of ag changed everything. It changed the face of food, of eating in this country. And so I think we have to sort of poke some fingers in the big bellies of corporations just to see what happens.
I like that. Every day, do something that won't compute. Well, I wanted to open up the show today by giving you a chance to do a little reading from your book, because I wanted my listeners to be able to hear from you a little bit about what they can expect should they pick up The Seed Underground, which they definitely should do. So would you mind sharing a short piece with us?
If you haven't heard what's happening with seeds, let me tell you. They're disappearing, about like everything else. You know the story already. You know it better than I do, the forests and the songbirds, the Appalachian Mountains, the fish in the ocean. But I'm not going to talk about anything that'll make us feel hopeless or despairing, because there's no despair in a seed. There's only life, waiting for the right conditions, sun and water, warmth and soil, to be set free. Every day, millions upon millions of seeds lift their two green wings.
Wow, that's beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you, Erin. That's just a little paragraph from the introduction. And maybe we could return for a minute. Every day, do something that won't compute. You know, in a way, we've become, so many of us now live in urban areas, 80% of us, and to think about writing a book about seeds and the planting of open pollinated seeds, it's a bit of a crazy idea with us, you know, no longer even in the industrial age, but more in the technological age. But I have this, I just have this feeling that we're really moving into a different age, which Thomas Berry calls the Ecozoic. And I think it will require of us that every day we do things, and increasingly more and more of us, and doing more and more things that just don't compute. Not to just go back to that quote, but it occurred to me that I hadn't explained that well enough.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's something that I'll be chewing on for a while. And one of the things that you talk about in your book that I would love to explore a little bit more today is, you know, in general in this country, I think we're pretty familiar with the movement of people over the course of the last 100 years from a predominantly rural society to a predominantly urban or suburban society. And along with this kind of shift in where we live and kind of how we live, there's also kind of this corollary shift in who's been responsible for our food supply. And, you know, it used to be something that was very intimate with regards to people primarily producing food for themselves or for a community that was very close to them physically. And it seems like there's been this shift away from that. And I'm wondering if you can maybe reflect a little bit on that shift and the role that seeds have played and how they've been impacted by this transition.
Mm-hmm. Great question, Erin. I may have said this to you before, but I sometimes look at my family as the sort of the poster child of American ag. My grandfather farmed a small diversified farm in southern Georgia. And indeed, he was responsible, or he and his family were responsible for feeding themselves and their neighbors, you know, with the sharing of some foodstuffs. We watched with the advent of the Green Revolution a sea change in American ag. We headed toward commercialization of food, which required shipping long distances and also required standardization, so more and more farmers planting to fewer and fewer varieties, and in this case, larger and larger acreages. So we did see a change, as you said, in who's responsible for our food supply, and we've almost wholesale now turned over the responsibility to industry, to corporations. And I think the role that the seed plays is to bring us back to the place where we take more responsibility. We don't exactly trust what corporations, multinationals, industry might be doing to us. We have an inkling that they're not acting in our best interest. We see rises in many, many diseases tied to nutrition and diet. And also, I think the further we get into a virtual age and less realness, the more we all hunger to have direct engagement with the land, with landscapes, with the world. I think that's enough said about that, except I will add that, you know, seeds were a victim in industrialization of ag. Farmers abandoned these old place-adapted vintage heirloom seeds. They had been growing, oftentimes family heirlooms, and you know, for hybrid seeds that had higher yields, and now since the mid 90s for genetically modified seeds, which also promise all kind of wonderful things. So yeah, that there you have it in a nutshell.
Well, how would you respond to I feel like we hear this kind of claim a lot in the political arena that, you know, corporations are people. They're composed of people. The decisions made by them are made by people. The benefits or the losses are felt by people. And, you know, I think it's easy often to just point to corporations or multinationals and say, like, they're the bad guys. And I want to... Not that I would necessarily disagree with that, but I just want to pull back a little bit and talk something about this phrase that you brought up in the last show, the monoculture of the mind. And I want to pick apart a little bit, you know, what is the mindset that allows for those decisions? I mean, if corporations are comprised of people, you know, where are we going wrong there, and how can we kind of unpack some of that?
So I don't think that corporations are people. I think corporations are piles of money that people that basically own people's actions. So it's a very different, you know, what I'm talking about here is a very different outlook on what corporations are, which makes it possible for corporations not to be held responsible in many, many cases for negative effects of their actions. Monocultures of the mind is a phrase that came from Vandana Shiva. Vandana is a great seed activist and author and seed banker from India. She's talking here about this, the mien that if a corporation is to succeed in doing what it does best, which is follow this model of progress, the uphill line, producing more and more profits for its shareholders, then it necessarily must enforce monocultures of the mind, meaning it has to, through whatever means possible, figure out how to make most people think alike. Advertising is the main way this is done, but there are other ways too. You know, it would be to a farmer putting the word out wholesale that your old, you know, your Keener corn or your branch corn or your Stanley corn or whatever your family's been growing for generations is not the right corn to be growing, that everybody's growing this new GM variety. In fact, 88% of the corn in this country grown is GM corn. So that's what monocultures of the mind means. I'm really interested in a woman, a scientist named Virginia Nazaria at the University of Georgia, and she wrote a book she's a cultural anthropologist looking at seed saving, and she uses the term the marginalities of the mind. So in contrast to the monocultures of thought, you have these people, these gardeners that I call quiet revolutionaries, who are keeping alive these heirloom, you know, traditional varieties of seeds, keeping alive genetic resources, curating all these amazing endangered tastes, and they do so at the margins of society, at the margins of what is accepted as the major trends in agriculture. So that's really what, you've nailed it. This is really what happened to heirloom seeds, is just changing landscapes in economics, in society, in agriculture. And it, a movement toward more, let me see how I would say this, more, the word is not ubiquitous, just more blanket thinking.
Well, sameness is kind of what comes to mind to me for some reason. This weird, and I think it's a very, strangely, it seems like a very un-American thing, this kind of broad-based push towards eating the same things and pursuing the same things. And I think historically in our country, that's never really been the case where, I mean, I think it's always been a place to come to kind of pursue your individuality, to exercise, you know, freedoms of choice. And I think it's so strange to me that quick drive towards, you know, being like everyone else, or each place you go looking like the place you just came from. I mean, it's something I'm often struck with when I travel through the country, is oftentimes it feels like I could essentially be anywhere in the country, because unless I'm in a more kind of dense urban environment or a more extremely rural environment, it seems like these things in between just don't have any distinguishing features, and that's deeply troubling and confusing to me, because I don't understand where that's coming from. And I wanted to talk about, in your book, you're very careful with deconstructing some of the language that is commonly used to talk about agriculture, or to talk about food, or to talk about seeds. And you talk about this use of the term conventional. I think often in farming conversations, we talk about organic agriculture versus conventional agriculture, and you kind of put forth a different definition of conventional. You hold conventional up against chemical agriculture, and I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that distinction.
And I get this, Aaron, from my husband, who's the real farmer around here, And we go to, we've been to many, many conferences on organic agriculture and so forth, and he'll often hear speakers talking, and they do say it's organic versus conventional. And, you know, we have to realize the power of rhetoric. George Lakoff wrote a book called Don't Think of an Elephant, which is if you tell people, you know, don't think of an elephant, don't think of an elephant, that's the one thing that you're going to think of. And so it makes some of the verbiage that we use, especially in government, you know, No Child Left Behind and Clean Skies Initiative, which really worsened air pollution. So I gave it some thought after he pointed that out to me, and I realized it's exactly right. There is nothing conventional about chemical agriculture. It's only been around, it's less than 100 years. You know, when my grandfather began to farm, he was farming the truly conventional system, which is the traditional system, a closed-loop system that uses animals on the farm for manures, that plants rye and other cover crops for green manures, that remineralizes the soil if possible, you know, that rotates crops, that plants a diversity of crops so that you're less beset with insects and disease. So, yes, it's just naming what is instead of letting other people control the language.
Thank you. We are going to take a short break and then come back for more Seed Talk, so stay tuned.
You're listening to Devil's Trail by Brothers.
Ranch grass-fed beef, pasture raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
We are back. You're listening to The Farm Report. I'm your host, Erin Fairbanks, and we are on the line with Janice Ray, author of The Seed Underground, and we are talking about seeds as they relate to pretty much everything, I think. So, Janice, one of the other topics you talk about in the book a lot is climate, and microclimates. You know, climate change is obviously something that is in the forefront of people's minds. I think in particular, this past year, having been such a weird weather summer across most of the U.S. and certain regions of the U.S. definitely feeling the impacts of reduced waterfall. I know just this past Sunday in the Times, they're talking about a pear-growing region in Southern California and kind of plans to divert water sources because so many areas of that region are really under stress for their water system. And I think seeds have historically played a really critical role in being adaptive to particular climates. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about kind of the risks that we're facing due to kind of our lack of protecting of seed varieties, in particular, kind of talking a little bit about exactly what is a microclimate and how seeds change over time to adapt. It's like eight questions there. I know. Sorry. Pick one.
Oh, no, no. What a wonderful question. And I'm just going to jump in. It's all about genetic resources. And DNA is so tricky because it's invisible. It's everywhere. It's hardly quantifiable. You know, kind of like love, you know, everywhere, invisible. And we don't want to lose any of it. And this is the reason why. A seed is more or less a natural memory stick. In it, it collects and stores climate data for generations, for the next generation of itself. Millions of years of DNA material is stored in a seed. 100 million years ago, flowering plants appeared on Earth. A couple hundred million years ago, humans. So you see, we come late to this biome, and we come with a long history of evolution of flowers evolving, pollinators evolving to pollinate those flowers, and then producing fruits and seeds that we came to use. Now, all this material, all this DNA, the genetic material, is still at our disposal. And we have no idea now in the early stages of climate change, already seeing huge climate variability. We don't know what genes we may need for our crops to adapt to these rapidly changing conditions, more drought in the southeast, in the southwest, you know, more fires coming through, more rainfall, large rain events, 4 inches dropped in one hour at our farm last week. So I think you and I talked about the lumper potato and what happened with the potato famine, that so many of the Irish families in the 1840s were growing lumper, and when late blight hit it, it caused a wholesale famine. So that's what the scientist in us is looking at, and not just the scientist, but the naturalist and the person who's concerned, the futurist, the eater in all of us. Looks at those diverse tastes and thinks, oh, gosh, I want to have 4 kinds of kale growing in the garden and all of them taste differently. And me be able to make different foods, different tradition. You know, there are beans traditionally used for baked beans, cranberry beans, for example. You're right, it's beyond taste, it's beyond the beauty of the farm stand and the beauty of our table. It really is about preparing the human species for the catastrophes that we've created that lie ahead of us.
So how does that work in practice? So, you know, if we're looking at, the state of Nebraska and the corn production there, and holding that out as this, you know, large-scale, chemically-based agriculture, experiencing drought. I mean, do they turn around in their next planting and look towards a different old variety, or are they driven to look towards a technological solution, or... How do we respond? You know, obviously it's challenging to respond within one growing season. So my sense would be that when you look to replant, you would make different seed choices as you try to anticipate the climate direction for that season. Or, you know, that, so that, that being kind of like one example, or on a smaller scale, if you're planting in your back garden, is it more kind of a natural thing that occurs, like as you plant or save seeds year after year, that things just kind of naturally adapt to what's happening around you? I mean, where is the intention, and how does that look different when you're talking about those two, you know, opposite ends of the scale?
It's so great to talk to you. Brilliant questions. My mind is roaming around a lot here with different ways that I can jump in. Let me do this. We didn't get to this point in an instant, and we won't get out of the troubles that we're in with our food system instantly. It's going to take time, so I'm not advocating that we drop all GM seeds from the market or all hybrid seeds from the market. I think that the change that I'm advocating, I know, is already happening, Aaron. I won't say the middle of it, but we're cresting. And the change is happening among young people deciding that farming is a noble profession and deciding to become farmers and really just wanting a life that's authentic, that makes sense, that's real, not virtual, that puts them in daily contact with the natural processes of the earth. And that means deciding that they're going to grow organically or however, grow small, grow diversified, grow the culture, grow community as they grow food. The ability of a plant to respond can't happen completely in one generation. It has to happen over time. And you're exactly right. Through something called selection pressure, which is if we planted 100 a Jimmy Nardello bell pepper, then and we were beset by an enormous drought. There will be a few of the peppers that do better than others, and so those would be seeds that we'd select for the next generation. Then we would plant those, and that's the way we have to do this. Unfortunately, there are no quick answers, and it's just never going to be 2 + 2 right now. It's always going to be, well, Paul Grucco, a wonderful Midwestern writer, he talks about the model of history, of how humans move through life. And he talks about the uphill line of progress, which is the one most corporations would embrace. And he also talks about the more traditional one, which is a cycle. It's a circle. So we've got an uphill line. We've got a circle, which is, you know, returning back again and again to where you were, the cycles of seasons. But probably the more apt model for human progress is a meandering line. You go in one direction and then you correct. Something corrects you and you go in another direction. Now, sadly, climate change may correct us very quickly, but I think that's our model, a meandering line.
That sounds true to my personal life experience. Well, we are almost out of time. I wanted to touch on the Doomsday Vault in Norway. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that particular operation with regards to seed saving.
The Svalbard Vault, Global Seed Vault, was finished in 2008. It's about 700 miles south of the North Pole within the country of Norway. It's lined with it's a tunnel blasted into a mountain that's lined with a meter's width of concrete. Countries from all over the world have been placing seed varieties there. We have. The Seed Savers Exchange has sent hundreds of varieties, as have our seed banks. Inside the vault, the temperature is naturally about 23 degrees Fahrenheit, but refrigeration units bring it farther down to minus 4 degrees. Seeds stored there in airtight, watertight packages are hoped to be safe from whatever the future brings. Genetic engineering gone wild, a comet hitting the Earth, the worst-case scenarios of climate change, seas rising, and so forth. The seeds in it, even though a seed has a lifespan that's fairly short in your or my, you know, back room or even in our refrigerator, the seeds there are hoped to live anywhere from 50 to 2,000 years. My only concern about this Svalbard vault is that it's not a foolproof thing in that a seed does have longevity. I think the more perfect way to save seeds would be out in the world, adapting to the changes, intermingling, getting to know other squash better. It's the highly militaristic locks on the door style of food security, as opposed to the let's intermingle style of food security. Gardens are living gene banks.
They're also something that we can all participate in a way that the vault is not. Well, Denise, thank you so much for joining us once again. Her book, The Seed Underground, A Growing Revolution to Save Food, is available wherever books are sold. The publisher is Chelsea Green Publishing. They are awesome. Check them out at www.chelseagreen.com. Stay tuned. After the Farm Report, we will have a green market update, but that is it for today. You can tune into the show through iTunes. Everything is available as a free download. HeritageRadioNetwork.org has over 25 live weekly shows. We have also recently partnered with Stitcher Radio, a wonderful app that you can download on your iPhones or your Android or your iPad, any of the stuff it's compatible with. So check it out. And tune in next Thursday at 1 o'clock for another episode of The Farm Report. Thanks for listening.
What's hot at the green market? You're about to find out now. It's the Grow NYC Market Update.
All right, you heard it here. We are on the line with Liz Carollo of New York City's Green Market, and we are about to tuck into the market update. Liz, what is going on at the market?
Hey, Erin. The market, it's full-on summer at its peak right now. The tomatoes coming in. We have over 200 varieties of tomatoes in the green market system. So they're in abundance right now, and because there's so many flooding the market, they're really affordable. So now's the time to stock up on tomatoes and do some canning so you have them to enjoy all winter long. Everything's on that 2 to 3 week earlier schedule this year. So this week we've seen pears, apples, and even grapes showing up at the market. And now's the time to get the blueberries, raspberries, blackberries, melons before they're gone for the season, because fall is going to be here before you know it. I also want to encourage people to maybe check out some of the specialty Mexican varietals that we have. I got to the market this morning, and down the block you could smell the papalo, the papiche epazote. We have some really great varieties of herbs that maybe people aren't familiar with, but you can always ask the market manager or the farmer to kind of explain what their flavor is and how to cook with them. But one product I really wanted to spotlight today is grapes. So this week, Concords and Green Seedless came in from Locust Grove Orchards. One of our beloved farmers, Buzzard Crest Vineyards, will be coming back in a couple of weeks. They have an amazing variety of grapes and kind of to die for juice, and they only show up at the market for 3 weeks to a month, depending on how long the grapes last for. So it's one of those things where you kind of have to get them while they're here. And so you'll see grapes at the market for the next month, month and a half. And I want to encourage people to, you know, not just snack on grapes, even though they are amazingly delicious and like nothing you would find outside of the market, but also to maybe, you know, turn them into jam and test them out in a savory dish because they add that perfect amount of sweetness to a lot of meat dishes that you're cooking. Let's see, what else is happening? We have some kind of general market happenings. We started a Bring Your Own Bag campaign. We're trying to explain to green market customers how to, you know, the detrimental effects of plastic and to bring their own bag to the market. We're partnering with Green YC, which is the outreach and education arm of the Mayor's Plan YC initiative. So we're just trying to spread the word and encourage people to bring their own bags and not take plastic while they're at the market. We have our Sandwich Smackdown coming up, so we're doing that through our youth education program. We're going to have teams, 15 teams of youth with a couple of chaperones making sandwiches inspired by market ingredients at Union Square in the Park House on September 8th, Saturday. So we're still looking for teams to compete, and the event is free for event goers, so you just have need to register, and all that info is on our website. And also, we're partnering with R Goods. So R Goods is an organization that helps people kind of connect to provide barter opportunities for one another, and they're going to do a thing called the Unsold Supper. It's the second year. It's September 15th, again, in the Union Square Park House, and it starts at 6, and it's a really great event. It's free. It's open to anyone. You can just come and eat with farmers and other people in the community, and we're going to encourage people to figure out what they can barter with farms. So say they want to teach English or provide graphic design opportunities or help farmers build a website, and in return, the farmers will provide something to the person that's helping them. So that's a really great event, and also the event information's on our website.
Awesome. That sounds great. So many things happening.
Yeah. Also, we have this weekend, we have two canning classes, so they're free workshops. One's at the 82nd Street Green Market, and one's at the Columbia University Green Market. So 82nd Street on Saturday, Columbia on Sunday. Our resident canner, Robin Fuskis, will be out there answering all the questions about pH and any other canning questions people have.
Awesome. Wow.
Yeah, Liz. We're busy, and we're just going to get busier going into fall. August is actually the slow month.
Well, I can't wait to hear the update in the weeks to come. If you out there listening want more info on the farmers, the market, or want to hear about some great volunteer opportunities, check out the website, www.grownyc.org, and you can follow the Grow NYC crew on Twitter. They have a bunch of different handles, a couple that we'll share with you today, at GAP Green Market, that's for the Grand Army Plaza Market here in Brooklyn, and at UNSQ Green Market for the Union Square Green Market. So tune in next week for the latest and greatest from the market update. Liz, we'll talk to you soon.
Great, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.